secrets of his various creations, revealing just a little more each year. By 1935, on his 79th birthday, Tesla, although exceedingly gaunt, was still exuberant and expected to live past 110. His mind ever evolving, the sorcerer utilized this occasion to lay out in considerable detail the various particulars of a number of his more exotic creations. With movie cameras rolling and the inventor treating the press, about 30 in number, to a gourmet's luncheon, Mr. Tesla sat at the head of the table. Eating little more than bread and warm milk, which he heated up in a chafing dish at the table, the wizard talked while the reporters feasted. Inventor 81 talks of key to interstellar transmission and tube to produce radium copiously and cheaply. Reports of discoveries by which it would be possible to communicate with the planets and to produce radium in unlimited quantities for $1 a pound were announced by Dr. Nikola Tesla yesterday on his 81st birthday, at which he was honored with high orders from the Yugoslav and Czechoslovak governments. I am expecting to put before the Institute of France an accurate description of the devices with data and calculations, and claim the Pierre Gutzmann Prize of 100,000 francs for means of communication with other worlds, feeling perfectly sure that it will be awarded to me. The money, of course, is a trifling consideration, but for the great historical honor of being the first to achieve this miracle, I would be almost willing to give my life. I am just as sure that the prize will be awarded to me as if I already had it in my pocket. They have got to do it. It means it will be possible to convey several thousand units of horsepower to other planets, regardless of the distance. This discovery of mine will be remembered when everything else I have done is covered with dust. In discussing this invention, one runs into murky waters, for it appears that Tesla tied the concept of the radium-producing tube to the interplanetary communicator. These, however, may be two unrelated creations. Another problem was that the inventor was also discussing at this time the idea of capturing cosmic rays that travel at velocities 50 times greater than that of light. If this invention utilized cosmic rays, it would imply that Tesla planned to transcend the speed of light and communicate with other stars. In reading the text carefully, it appears that Tesla does not mention other stars, but rather the planets, which are relatively close to the Earth. Furthermore, he doesn't really discuss communicating with extraterrestrials so much as transmitting energy. It is known that as early as 1918, while working with Coleman Cheeto's son Julian, the inventor was bouncing laser-like pulses off the moon and testing some type of scope. Therefore, it is possible that he was working on more than one device to send energy into outer space. Verification for Tesla that there existed particles that traveled faster than the speed of light were purportedly discovered in the late 1890s when he invented a device to capture radiant energy. The machine, patented on November 5, 1901, comprised in essence an insulated plate resembling a fly swatter made out of the best quality of mica as dielectric. This was attached to a condenser. Stemming from his work with radiant energy, X-rays and Leonard tubes, the device could also capture what he called cosmic rays. I made some progress in solving the mystery until in 1899 I obtained mathematical and experimental proofs that the sun and other heavenly bodies similarly conditioned emit rays of great energy which consist of inconceivably small particles animated by velocities vastly exceeding that of light. So great is the penetrative power of these rays that they can traverse thousands of miles of solid matter with but slight diminution of velocity. In passing through space, which is filled with cosmic dust, they generate a secondary radiation of constant intensity day or night, and pouring upon the Earth equally from all directions. Since Victor Hess's discovery in 1911 and Robert Millikan's confirmation, there have been many scientists who have measured cosmic rays. We now know that emitted uncharged elementary particles, known as neutrinos, possess the penetrative powers suggested by Tesla, but no researcher, to my knowledge, has discovered rays that transcend the speed of light. This supposed finding of Tesla also violated relativity. Tesla was insistent that such particles did exist. He saw them as a source which could be converted into electrical power. During the summer of 1932, he told Jack O'Neill that he had harnessed the cosmic rays and caused them to operate a motive device. The attractive features of the cosmic rays is their constancy. They shower down on us through the whole 24 hours, and if a plant is developed to use their power, it will not require devices for storing energy, as would be necessary with devices using wind, tide, or sunlight. When pressed for more details, Tesla revealed that he would tell O'Neill, in a general way, their modus operandi. The cosmic rays ionize the air, setting free many charges, ions and electrons. These charges are captured in a condenser which is made to discharge through the circuit of the motor. Tesla also told O'Neill that he had hopes of building such a motor on a large scale. Free energy? As the years rolled on, it became a challenge for reporters to wrestle more details about each invention from the wizened prestidigitator, since Tesla continued to maintain his perpetual reticence about revealing particulars. Concerning the cosmic ray accumulator, the reporters were able collectively to pry from the inventor the following. My power generator will be of the simplest kind, just a big mass of steel, copper, and aluminum, comprising a stationary and rotating part, peculiarly assembled. Such a source of power obtainable everywhere will solve many problems with which the human race is confronted. The machinery for harnessing it would last more than 5,000 years. Cosmic rays, he asserted, are produced by the force of electrostatic repulsion. They consist of powerfully charged positive particles which come to us from the sun and other suns in the universe. He determined, after experimentation, that the sun is charged with an electrical potential of approximately 215 billion volts. Owing to its immense charge, the sun imparts to minute positively electrified particles prodigious velocities which are governed only by the ratio between the quantity of free electricity carried by the particles and their mass, some attaining a speed exceeding 50 times that of light. At great altitudes, the intensity of the rays is more than 10,000% greater than at sea level. The energy of the cosmic radiations impinging upon the Earth from all sides is stupendous, such that if all of it were converted into heat, the globe would quickly be melted and volatilized. Rising air currents partially neutralize their intensity. Those who are still doubting that our sun emits powerful cosmic rays evidently overlook that the solar disk, in whatever position it may be in the heavens, cuts off the radiations from beyond, replacing them by its own. Coupled with his view that all bodies in the universe obtain their energy from external sources, and possibly influenced by Walter Russell, an artist, philosopher, and longtime friend of Tesla's, who hypothesized that the periodic table of elements was constructed in a hierarchical spiral of octaves, Tesla was led to the inescapable conclusion that such bodies as the sun are taking on mass much more rapidly than they are dissipating it by the dissipation of energy in heat and light. Similarly, radioactive decay was not caused by the disintegration of the nucleus of the atom. Rather, it was a secondary effect of external rays and twofold, one part coming from the energy stored, the other from that continuously supplied. In other words, radioactive material was, to Tesla, apparently a kind of conduit for the ever-present primary substance, Akasha, which was being absorbed in such a way as to cause the emission of the radioactive material. These Tesla offerings would appear as evidence of a great mind gone astray, for the various discoveries and suggestions inherent in Tesla's theory violate not only such accepted theories as relativity and quantum physics, but also on the surface, common sense. The idea that the inventor could construct a simple device made up basically of a receiving plate and a condenser to provide electricity to run motors from cosmic rays harks the listener back to the inane days of the Keeley motor and the obtuse concepts of perpetual motion and free energy. Yet underneath the veneer of the theory is an exciting notion, that the sun is somehow absorbing energy from the universe, and that there does exist some form of it which transcends the limiting factor of the speed of light. Called by other researchers tachyons, i.e. particles that travel faster than the speed of light, and linked to other such concepts as black holes, wormholes, string theory, non-locality, the implicate order, hyperspace, gravitons, and Max principle, Tesla's theories, when viewed within the matrix of the bizarre new physics, may not be so far out. Another of Tesla's discoveries involved the transmission of mechanical energy to distant places. By strategically placing one of his mechanical oscillators on, for example, solid bedrock, a mechanical impulse could be sent into the ground to accomplish at least four practical possibilities. It would give the world a new means of unfailing communication. It would provide a new safe means for guiding ships at sea into port, furnish a kind of divining rod for locating ore deposits, and finally, it would provide scientists with a means for laying bare the physical conditions of the Earth. The essential principle behind this invention is, of course, used today in sonar for ships and by geophysicists in studying the interior of the Earth, mapping fault lines, studying the core, and so on. Tesla at 78, Bayer's new death beam. Dr. Tesla has perfected a method and apparatus which will send concentrated beams of particles through the free air of such tremendous energy that they will bring down a fleet of 10,000 enemy airplanes at a distance of 250 miles from a defending nation's border, and will cause armies of millions to drop dead in their tracks. Tesla's discovery of a death ray stems all the way back to his work in the early 1890s with his creation of a button lamp that would bounce electrons off a central filament made of almost any substance, e.g. carbon, diamonds, zirconia, rubies, onto the interior of a self-reflective bulb and then bounce back to the source. This device would not only produce an extraordinary brilliant light, it would also vaporize the button. As stated previously, it was only a short step from this machine to the invention of the ruby laser. For instance, if there was a scratch or imperfection in the coating of the glass, the energy would stream out through this opening in laser-like fashion. In the late 1890s, Tesla was bombarding targets with X-rays at distances in excess of 40 feet, and by 1915 he had announced in the New York Times a type of electronic defensive shield which today corresponds to what has been called SDI, or Strategic Defense Initiative. Harry Grindle Matthews. During World War I, another Teslarian, Harry Grindle Matthews, was provided with £25,000 by the British government for the creation of a searchlight beam which he said could control aircraft. A wireless electrician and veteran of the British Army, wounded at the turn of the century during the Boer War, Grindle Matthews eventually refined this invention and changed it into a diabolical ray. This new electronic beam, he said, could not only destroy zeppelins and airplanes, but also immobilize marching armies and nautical fleets. Although he would not divulge the specifics of his creation, he made no secret of his admiration for Tesla, whose technologies had inspired its groundwork. In July 1924, Grindle Matthews traveled to America to see an eye specialist. He probably met with Hugo Gernsback at that time and might also have visited Tesla. Staying at the Hotel Vanderbilt, the British inventor was interviewed by a number of the local dailies. "Let me recall to you the air attacks on London during the World War. Searchlights picked up the German raiders and illuminated them while guns fired, hitting some but more often missing them. But suppose instead of a searchlight, you directed my ray. So soon as it touches the plane, this bursts into flame and crashes to the earth." Grindle Matthews was also convinced that the Germans had such a ray. They were using a high-frequency current of 200 kilowatts, which as of yet they were unable to control. Working with the French government in Lyon and performing successful tests before members of the British War Office, Grindle Matthews instituted destructive effects at distances of 60 feet, but was hoping to extend the force to a radius of 6 or 7 miles. Asked for specifics, he said that his device utilized two beams, one as a carrier ray and the other as the destructive current. The first beam would constitute a low frequency and would be projected through a lens. The second, of a higher frequency, would increase conductivity so that destructive power would be more easily transmitted. The motor of an airplane, for instance, could be the contact point at which the paralyzing ray would do its handiwork. He admitted, however, that if the object were grounded, it would be protected against such a force. Hugo Gernsback, along with Dr. W. Severinghouse, a physicist from Columbia University, tried unsuccessfully to duplicate the effects, using heat beams, X-rays, and ultraviolet rays. Doubting Grindle-Matthews' claims, Gernsback nevertheless featured the diabolical ray with characteristic Frank Paulian panache on the cover of his magazine and with a series of exposés. Leaders from other countries were less critical than Gernsback, and many proclaimed that their scientists also had such diabolical rays. Herr Wüller, a member of the German Reichstag, announced that three German scientists have perfected apparatus that can bring down airplanes, halt tanks, and spread a curtain of death like gas clouds of the recent war. Not to be outdone, Leon Trotsky stated that the Soviets had also invented such a device. Warning all nations, Trotsky proclaimed, "I know the potency of Gramachikov's ray, so let Russia alone." This theme of all-powerful, efficient weaponry reappeared during the 1930s as the seeds of World War II were sown. At this time, Tesla began to reveal more and more about his own diabolical ray as he criticized the Grindle-Matthews scheme. "It is impossible to develop such a ray," Dr. Tesla says. "I worked on that idea for many years before my ignorance was dispelled, and I became convinced that it could not be realized. This new beam of mine consists of minute bullets moving at a terrific speed, and any amount of power desired can be transmitted by them. The whole plant is just a gun, but one which is incomparably superior to the present." The inventor further claimed that the new weapon, which was to be used for defense only, comprised four new inventions. One, an apparatus for producing the rays. Two, a process for producing immense electrical power. Three, a method for amplifying the power. And four, a tremendous electrical repelling force. Working in two undisclosed locations, including a secret laboratory under the 59th Street Bridge near 2nd Avenue, Tesla perfected his particle beam weapon as he conspired with unabashed anarchist and architect Titus de Bobula to design the all-purpose power plant that could generate high voltages or capture cosmic rays and convert them into his defensive electronic shield. Believing that entire countries could be protected by such plants, the inventor clandestinely approached the war departments of each of the Allies with his scheme.
45. Living on credit, 1925 to 1940.
"If you mean the man who really invented, in other words, originated and discovered, not merely improved what had already been invented by others, then without a shade of doubt, Nikola Tesla is the world's greatest inventor, not only at present, but in all history."
Hugo Gernsback. Tesla was leading a double life in his later years, one as the elegant author of the electrical power system and father of the wireless, and another, more labyrinth existence, as the quintessential mad scientist, whose ultimate creations would rule not only the Earth, but other worlds as well. In 1935, with the help of newsreel photographers, Tesla designed and produced an electrified extravaganza which he offered to Paramount Pictures.
"Paramount said the film came out unusually good, both in respect to pictorial and sound effects," he told George Scherf, "but they feel that the subject was too technical."
Nevertheless, Teslaic themes continue to make their way into the mass consciousness. The most important movie person to implement the inventor's wizardry was revolutionary movie producer Carl Laemmle and his special effects expert Kenneth Strickfaden. Together, they unleashed one of Tesla's unforgettable coils in the Boris Karloff classic Frankenstein. Strickfaden also resurrected the same paraphernalia 40 years later, when Mel Brooks recreated the set for the spoof Young Frankenstein. Tesla was partial to Laemmle, whom he referred to as a genius, because Laemmle too successfully fought the powerful Edison clique a generation earlier, when Edison held a monopoly on key movie-making patents and would not allow competitors to use them. Routing his product through Europe, Lemley was able to withstand more than 200 legal actions against him to create Universal Pictures and thereby defeat Edison. Hugo Gernsback, of course, also continued to espouse Teslaic motives in science wonder stories, with such fresh galactic escapades as The Mightiest Machine, Interplanetary Bridges, and A City on Neptune. Other apostles, such as John Hays Hammond Jr. and Edwin Armstrong, were riding out the Great Depression, living like kings. Hammond's castle throughout the 1930s became a haven for Hollywood stars, corporate giants, and virtuosos. The retreat also doubled as a top-secret military think tank. As Tesla continued to work at his hideaway by the 59th Street Bridge, Edwin Armstrong continued to engage in a never-ending court battle with Leda Forrest over the invention of the heterodyne. Holding 80,000 shares of RCA stock, Armstrong was powerful enough to ride out the litigation as he continued to design a variety of new patents. Starting up his own radio station, Armstrong unveiled his newest invention, FM radio, a novel system which reduced such problems as static caused by ground interference so often encountered with AM. Little did Armstrong know that the litigation caused by this latest creation would make the DeForest trial seem like a kindergarten spat. Getting on in years, Tesla decided to hire a few Western Union boys to feed the pigeons for him. Dressed in their official caps and snappy uniforms, the lads could be seen like clockwork at 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. at three different locations around the city, in front of the New York Public Library, in Bryant Park at the library's rear, and at St. Patrick's Cathedral. The inventor had constructed special wooden cages, complete with a bird bath, for taking care of wounded as well as healthy feather friends, and he befriended other dove fanciers to whom he could deliver the birds. In 1925, Tesla's office was moved from 8 West 40th Street, near the New York Public Library, to fashionable quarters at 350 Madison Avenue. His secretaries, Dorothy Skerritt and Muriel Arbus, during the later years, shared duties with Slavic professor Paul Rado Sevelyevich from New York University, who edited Tesla's articles and screened incoming visitors. By 1928, however, the upkeep on the office had become too burdensome, and Tesla closed it for good. All of his holdings, consisting of 30 trunks, including his priceless correspondence, theoretical papers, and prototype inventions, were carted to the basement of the Hotel Pennsylvania, and that's where they remained until November the 21st, 1934, when he transferred them to the Manhattan storage warehouse located at 52nd Street and 7th Avenue. A contented member of the cognoscenti who had lived a life full of triumph was merely the persona. For underneath the appearance, Tesla was often bitter, seeking an essentially solitary existence, displacing his anger in editorials that lashed out at Edison and Marconi, and on unfortunate hotel managers who had to contend with the thought of throwing the Grand Master out on his coattails for not paying his rent. In 1930, Tesla was escorted out of the Hotel Pennsylvania after residents complained about the interminable droppings from his flying rats, and because he was $2,000 behind in his rent. As B.A. Behrendt quietly reimbursed the hotel to the best of his abilities, the inventor hired a crew to cart his beloved avian companions to George Scherf's home north of the city. Escaping their confinement, the pigeons returned to Manhattan just in time to move in with Tesla at his new abode, the Hotel Governor Clinton. Working on a variety of new fronts, Tesla entered a furtive realm which would put him in touch with a series of nefarious agents and heads of many governments. Naturally, he required funds, for he began to lag behind yet again in his rent. When he stopped by Hugo Gernsback's office for another $20, the science fiction editor showed Tesla an article on Westinghouse's new radio machinery. Realizing that this company was essentially pirating his wireless patents, Tesla strode into their offices and demanded royalty payments. He met with Victor Beam, assistant to the vice president. "It would be painful to me to resort to legal proceedings against a great corporation whose business is largely founded on my inventions," the inventor stated matter-of-factly, "and I trust that you will recognize the advantage of an amicable understanding." "Which statement do you claim to be an infringement?" Beam replied, feigning naivety.
Statement? Tesla shot back. Surely you must admit that my claim is too palpably evident to be denied.
Beam inquired as to the price of purchasing Tesla's wireless patent, number 1,119,732, but it was really a stall tactic, as no genuine offer was made. In exasperation, Tesla went home to draft a technical letter spelling out each and every infringement of his fundamental work and concluded, "We, Charles Scott and Tesla, have offered this revolutionary invention repeatedly, virtually on your own terms, and you did not want it. You have preferred to take it by force. You have robbed me of the credit that is due and injured me seriously in business. Instead of showing a willingness to adjust the matter in an equitable way, you say you want to fight. You may think you can secure an advantage by such matters, but we doubt it, and certainly they will not meet with public approval when all the facts are published." One of the problems Tesla had to deal with was the continuing legacy of resentment toward him by some members of the corporation. Unfortunately, one of the key antagonists was Andrew W. Robertson, a Westinghouse official who would soon become chairman of the company. Just a few years later, while Tesla was still alive, Robertson came to write a small treatise on the AC polyphase system for the 1939 World's Fair. In it, he neatly sidestepped any clear mention of Tesla's role in the development of the system, suggesting rather that William Stanley was the inventor. Robertson even had the audacity to write the following. "In George Westinghouse's time, an inventor was recognized as owner of his ideas and was given a patent to protect him in that ownership. Now we are told that patents are evil monopolies used to prevent people from getting the full benefits of an individual's work. If we are thinking clearly, we must draw the conclusion that these signs all point to a common hostility against the great inventor. If this hostility continues, it cannot but result in an environment certain to interfere with the growth and development of individual research and inventiveness." Here is a classic case of the Freudian defense mechanism known as projection, whereby one's real feelings are attributed to others. Robertson suggests that the common people resent the great inventor, when in fact it is really he who harbors this resentment. Tesla had first offered his wireless patents to the company in the early 1920s. A long time elapsed before the issue was resolved. As Tesla continued to make headlines for his invention of a diabolical ray, he also was becoming more and more adept at slipping past the manager of the Governor Clinton. If he had to wait for Westinghouse to come through, so would the hotel. Tesla was now working with the notorious architect and arms merchant, Titus de Bobula, whose offices were located at 10 East 43rd Street. De Bobula was hired to design the tower, power plant, and housing for the inventor's impenetrable shield between nations. "We can project destructive energy in thread-like beams as far as a telescope can discern an object," said the 78-year-old inventor. "Dr. Tesla's death ray can annihilate an army 200 miles away. It can penetrate all but the thickest armor plate, and a country's whole frontier can be protected with plants producing these beams every 200 miles. Dr. Tesla concluded, "The plane is thus absolutely eliminated as a weapon. It is confined to commerce." Born in 1878 in Hungary, with ties to Tesla probably through the Puskás brothers, de Bobulus had emigrated to the United States during the gay 90s. At that time, Tesla took the youth under his protection and aided him in obtaining passage for a boat trip back to his homeland. Short and stocky in stature, with a brush moustache and ruddy complexion, de Bobula returned to the States a few years later to study architecture. Having borrowed the money from Tesla ostensibly because he needed medical help in Budapest, de Bobula had actually returned home to help his father out in his moving business, and because he wanted to complete other studies at the local polytechnic. Never reimbursing the inventor for his aid and having lied about his real intentions, de Bobula apologized and appealed for funds once more in 1901. Writing from Marietta, Ohio, where he was attempting to design a church and school for a parish, he requested $70 or $80. Perhaps in lieu of repayment, the new architect offered to draw up plans for the laboratory at Wardenclyffe, but this assignment had already been undertaken by Stanford White. At about 1908, de Boisbilleux moved to Pittsburgh, where he met and married Urana Mock.